How good does it get, SK?
Why not us, Troy?
Today, live from the Pinecrest Inn, it's the Smiley Show. So long, everybody.
This is the Smiley Show.
All right, guys, happy to be joined by Sepp Straka. Sepp, what are you, like 7 minutes away from me? But we're going to do this over Riverside Zoom here because guess what? We're both dads. We both have bedtimes and responsibilities at the end of the night. Can take a toll on you. How was bedtime this evening getting the kids down?
Yeah, bedtime was good. I tackled Leo. Paige took Thomas.
Leo, what do we tackle?
Yeah, literally had to tackle him today. But no, he did great tonight, actually. No nap today, so proud of him for sticking it out and making it to bedtime.
Dude, when the kids don't take naps, at 5 o'clock to 7 o'clock hour, or hours, I should say, it's an eternity. It doesn't end. And boy, I love my kids more than anybody. But I tell you what, when they miss their naps in the end of the day, whew, it's tough. I don't know if you'll have the same problem.
No, it's like they don't have the energy, but they still want to do all the same things. And they can't. They just physically can't. Leo had a little fall today out there, outside on the pavement. So he got to play Dr. Leo and doctor himself back up. But yeah, other than that, it's actually pretty uneventful.
Dude, you sent a great picture to me earlier with Leo swinging the golf club. By the way, it looks like he's a potential to be a lefty, seeing that he had the left-hand low thing going on, or is he going Josh Broadway on tour?
I don't know. He does a lot of lefty stuff. He might be a Broadway, but he'll throw a ball lefty, so I don't know. But he definitely wants to swing the club right-handed. I mean,
okay, well, that's good.
Yeah. Yeah, he...
it's a relief, I don't know. Right?
Yeah, it is. It is. I mean, lefty, they live a harder life in the golf world. Everybody knows it. So,
But have you ever seen a bad lefty golf swing?
They all look pure. But then when you reverse them, they all look weird. So I don't really know. Have you ever seen Phil's golf swing reverse?
Yeah, it's just like... I don't like it.
It's so pure lefty. But you reverse it, it's like, who is this guy?
Yeah, I think I'm with you. But hey, if he got into baseball and was a lefty, you know... batting from the other side of the plate, this guy, you know, it's a couple rounds he could get drafted up in that MLB draft, and I know he's going to have power to both sides of the field, being a son of a Sepp Straka here.
I don't know. I hope he won't inherit my baseball talents, but maybe if he can get on your team, you can coach him up a little bit.
Yeah, I don't think people realize that we live in the same hometown and we have kids the exact same age, two boys now that are going to be in the same grade. I mean, I think you and I have a good opportunity to potentially coach linebackers, coach cornerbacks of some middle school, some junior football teams or baseball teams. And look out. I mean, I think with us as coaches, it could be great, but it also could end terribly too.
Yeah, I know. Maybe we need to just step aside a little bit, but with the talent level, you know, then we might be running the little leagues here in Vestavia soon.
I know we're gonna win some state championships in golf, though. I'll tell you that right now.
Yeah, if Leo keeps playing the way he is now, I mean, he's on a great pace. So.
Oh my goodness! Well, it's so fun to be a dad. I know you enjoy it just as much as I do, but it's also so difficult being a dad and being a pro and traveling on the road and trying to wear all the different hats. And you've done it so well. You've climbed all the way up to 12th in the world. But I don't think we've actually had a full conversation with you, Sepp, to this point, to where we really can kind of dive into your journey really to the PGA Tour. I think everybody recognizes you now, playing Ryder Cups, winning on the PGA Tour. But you're a twin. Obviously, Sam Straka was who I knew growing up a little bit more, because Sam was the one I played with and I struggled beating Sam because he was really
good.
As a junior, he hammered the golf ball and I think was probably more of a high profile player than you in junior golf. Nothing against you, but
no, I mean, no doubt about that. Yeah.
Just kind of talk about that development in junior golf and having a brother that was really pushing you to climb to the level that he was at.
Yeah, it was great to have him. It really was. I mean, I was always trying to basically make myself as good as him. I mean, he was an excellent junior player, played in all the invitational AJGA stuff, and I never got into those tournaments, so I was always playing SJGTs in the open AJGA events, and my goal was always to beat Sam. It was always kind of the benchmark, and
still is.
And it was a pretty well. Now it's a must. Now if I don't beat him now, then I'll hear about it for quite a while. So But no, he was a baller. He was really good all the way through early years of college, and that was always kind of my benchmark growing up, was to try to beat Sam. And yeah, it definitely made both of us better players, I think, just to always have that competition.
Yeah, except do you think that allowed you to play with a little bit of a chip on your shoulder? You know, everybody always kind of talking about Sam growing up, how good he was. Did that help you and motivate you to work harder?
Maybe a little bit. Yeah, I think it's kind of my personality too. I'm kind of more of a laid back, behind the scenes guy. I'm not like very big on social media or anything like that. I don't put myself out there much. So, it's always kind of my style to fly in under the radar. And yeah, I think that started at an early age with Sam. I mean, he was always, obviously, for a good reason, drawing the headlines, getting the letters from the coaches and all that. So, yeah, that always kind of has been my MO, and it really kind of still is today.
I mean, you played at Georgia for 4 years. You're basically in the lineup the whole time, but the recruitment to Georgia, did it happen kind of late in the process for you? Did you feel like Georgia was going to be an option? Obviously, Sam was being recruited heavily, but was there at one point, did you feel like Georgia was not a part of the equation, or did it kind of slide in late?
Yeah, it was always, they always recruited Sam, because obviously he was a really good player. I think through Sam, they kind of started watching me a little bit, and they were like, well, this guy's not too bad, you know, he's got a decent swing. And yeah, I guess a few things happened. I was honestly shocked when they offered both of us to go there. But yeah, I'm so fortunate to be able to play there, because that system was set up so well for me to try to improve my golf game, and definitely wouldn't be where I am now without it.
All right, so who were some of the older guys when you were a freshman when you got to Georgia?
So when I got to Georgia, that was the year after Harris Hudson and Russell all left.
I
So
mean,
we
talk
had,
about like a trio, dude.
and we were not good enough to fill those shoes. Not even close. So that was big shoes to fill. But then year above me was Keith Mitchell. He's on
Chromie?
tour. Joey Garber, Chromie was also the year above me. Him and Joey Garber was also the year above me. So those three guys were the year ahead, and we were a pretty young team. I mean, we had one redshirt junior on the team, TJ Mitchell, and then that was it. We had Bryden McPherson on the team for a little while. He won the British Amateur back then, and but yeah, we were a very young team. And but it was, I mean, it was a blast. It was so much fun to get to play with those guys.
What was Hacker's coaching style? Like, kind of describe how he would run a practice.
You know, Doug, I guess, I don't know. Hacker didn't do a whole lot of hands-on coaching, I would say. He was more of I'm going to set up this system for y'all to succeed. If you need anything, let me know. But you know, he's not going to give you swing advice or tell you what club to hit. That wasn't really his style. He had an unbelievable system in place that I think people that wanted to improve and play in the lineup really thrived in that environment, because like I wasn't a very highly recruited player. A lot of schools I wouldn't have gotten to play my first few years. But at Georgia, it's all qualifying. You just qualify for each tournament. Everybody qualifies no matter who you are. If you finish top 10 in a tournament, you get exempt in the next week, just like on the PGA Tour. So that was it. I remember 1 year, Sam had already not been playing very well for a year or so, 2 years. And Joey Garber was the number one amateur in the world, and or at least in the college rankings. And Sam beat him out in qualifying to qualify for a tournament, Kiawah. Joey ended up going as individual and winning as an individual.
Stop it.
So yeah, that was pretty fun. I mean, but stuff like that happened all the time, you know. Just if you just didn't qualify, then you weren't gonna be in the lineup.
How did Sambo play at Kiawah
I don't think he played very well. He had one of
that
his go-to in college was the, I mean, there was a few tournaments. He won a time or two in college, but other than those, he pretty much go shoot 65, then 78, and then 66. I mean, it's just kind of, if you had four other solid players, he'd be a great asset, because you know he's going to throw a low one in there, but there was always a high one lurking.
What did Ricky Bobby say? If you ain't first, you're last. Is
That's right.
that
Yeah, he
Sam
went for
Straka right
it. Yeah,
there?
he went for it for sure.
Aiming for the fences, Sam Straka, man. You should watch this guy hit a golf ball. Is he lost any speed? I haven't played with him.
Yeah.
Gosh, it's been 4 or 5 years. Is he lost some pop in the bat?
Unfortunately, yes. He doesn't play much anymore. I mean, he still plays a little bit, but he's busy working, and definitely lost a little speed. But there for a while, I mean, right after college, right during college, it was pretty silly. The numbers he was, that was before TrackMan really, so we didn't even measure the numbers, but I mean, he was hitting balls that everybody on the team was amazed with. So it was silly to watch there at times.
I mean, if you've been listening to this interview long enough and you didn't know who Sepp Straka, you never listened to him talk, but all you saw him play was at the Ryder Cup on the European team, you start to realize, like, wait, should he be wearing the red, white, and blue? And you're like, well, yeah, I mean, he's got a nice southern drawl to him from Valdosta, Georgia, but of course, you got your Austrian background with your parents. And I wanted to talk about Sam. What did he caddy for you at the Olympics? Was it the Olympics where he caddied for you?
Caddy for me at the Olympics in Japan. Yeah, 2020.
What was that experience like? You know,
that was
wearing I keep trying to say Australian. It's Austrian colors. That had to just be so cool, you know, being an American boy, but, you know, with your parents and their background, it's got to be something that you both were very proud of.
Yeah, it was awesome. I mean, it was a blast, especially to have Sam on the back there. You know, we grew up playing, we started playing golf in Austria. We played on the Austrian junior golf team, played in the European boys team championships for Austria. So
What year was that? Like, how old were y'all?
the European boys, we were probably 16 at the time.
When'd y'all get to
Yeah.
Valdosta?
When we were 14. So we went back that summer and
Gotcha.
played over there. That was in Prague.
That's why y'all are so fluent. Is it what language is it? Is it
German, yeah.
German? Okay.
Yeah. So yeah, we lived there till we were 14, and then but we kept playing for Austria in all the team events, and so that was really special to have him on the bag there that week. We had a great time.
But where did y'all play in Austria growing up?
We grew up just south of Vienna, at a place called Fontana. It was an
Yeah.
awesome track. They had a European tour event there every year, so that was our first experience of watching golf, was going to that tournament and watching Monty and Marcus Breer was the Austrian legend that he won it one year, and it was a blast.
What was the weather like there growing up as a kid?
So summers are great. Summers are pretty hot during the day, cools down to like the low 70s at night, maybe high 60s.
It's pretty
Yeah,
pure.
so I mean it
It's
was
pretty
great. It
pure.
was Summers are perfect. Spring and fall are good too, but winters are definitely cold. There was probably about 4 months where you couldn't play golf at all, and then 1 month on either end where it was a bit dicey.
Gosh, what are your memories like all the way up to you're 14 years old? So it's got to be somewhat like it feels like a past lifetime growing up in a different country. Is it What are your memories of growing up in Austria?
It was great. I loved it. I mean, we always split some time. So we always would come to the States in the summer, and then
Gotcha.
when we were in the States for high school, we'd go over there for a few weeks each summer. So it was always kind of split on time between the two. But no, it was awesome. It was great. The golf scene was really cool. I mean, Austria is a small country, so you play the same guys every week. But it was fun to kind of get some friendships and get to know the guys really well. And I remember now still Matthias Schwab.
Yeah.
Matthias Schwab, Sam and I. Matthias was, I think, 2 years younger than us, 1 or 2 years younger than us. And we always, I mean, he was a baller, especially at a young age. He was really good. And so we always had great matches, great tournaments. And yeah, it was a blast.
So when you got to Valdosta, how easy and how quickly were you brainwashed to become an Atlanta Braves fan and a Georgia Bulldog? Like, was it instant? Like, is it just part of growing up in Georgia?
Yeah, so that started early. I think that's in my DNA. My mom's from
Yeah.
South Georgia, so we went to the first Braves game when we were like, I don't know, 10 or 11. I think we did a trip up there with my whole family on my mom's side, and yeah, I've been a Braves fan forever, and my mom's family is also a Georgia fan, so that was a pretty
It's in your
easy
blood.
easy pick as soon as that offer came.
You
Yeah,
got red in your blood, like legit
that's
red.
right.
Atlanta Braves, Georgia Bulldogs. Well, it's a shame, really, but the Georgia Bulldog part. But I can get behind the Atlanta Braves bit. But another decision you made right after college, of course, you had a great career at the University of Georgia. But you know, right after you finish there, you have to make a decision of, you know, what company you're going to sign with, what golf ball you're going to play. You ultimately choose Srixon. Can you just tell me about just the process of ending up with Srixon, and you've been with them your entire career?
Yeah, it was pretty interesting. It was back when, so I was Nike in college. Georgia's obviously Nike school. Was Nike in high school. I was always a Nike guy, and then all of a sudden they stopped making clubs. So I was kind of literally, I could pretty much go anywhere I wanted with absolutely no ties because I'd always only played Nike. So I just did a lot of testing, just went through all the companies, went through everything, and absolutely loved Srixon's iron and wedges and the ball too. Those are the three things that were kind of the most important to me. And yeah, absolutely loved all that. So I was kind of a free agent and lucked into kind of signing with what I think is pretty undisputable, the best iron in golf.
Oh, the irons are just incredible. Any amateur, any pro will tell you the same. It's just so good going through the turf. And let's talk a little bit about the golf ball. So when you went and did the testing, what were some of the first things you noticed?
The biggest thing for me was the wind. I felt like in the wind, the ball just was so much better than all the other ones that I tried. I always was kind of a lower spin guy, so I always played the XV. But I just thought the wind hardly touched the golf ball, especially the smaller, you know, puffs of wind that you would get that are unexpected. I felt like it kind of just went right through that better than any of the other balls that I tried. And
right.
Rarely do you ever play around a golf without wind. So I thought that was a pretty important part.
It's good when it's Z-Star, and there's two options now too. And I know you and I have had like a ton of discussions about which golf ball you play and why. Right now you're playing the XV, which is the red. And then also there's the XV Diamond, which is the gold. And I know you've played both. And just tell me about what you like in the XV golf ball. And if you ever did play the Diamond, what would be the reason why?
Yeah, I did a stint with the Diamond a couple years back. I think it was when it was first coming out. And I loved it. I think the Diamond's great. You know, it just gives you a little more spin on the irons. And at the time, maybe it was just I was playing on the West Coast. It was my long irons were not they weren't staying in the air very well. It was it was kind of losing a little spin. And I was like, I'll just go to this little more spinny one. And it was great. I loved it. It was incredible. Still in the wind, performed unbelievably well. It was awesome. And then after a few months, I did a little bit of work on my golf swing. I think started hitting a little more crisp and was seeing a little more of that spin come back. So I went back to the XV, but
right.
Such a great option to go to if you're, you know, if you're looking for just a little more spin, even if it's just a certain week, you know, if you're, you know, you're not going to have a lot of wind, there's going to be firm green somewhere. You could just jump into a little more spinny ball and know you're going to get the same performance.
I can relate to that. I'm a seasonal golf ball player when it comes to either the Diamond or the XV based off the greens or the temperature. And speaking of just improvement in your game, did you see that right after college making the switch to Srixon with a golf ball that's a little bit better in the wind, some irons that are obviously so good? Did you notice immediately that your game had gotten better?
Yeah, I mean, I'd say I was pretty nervous about it because all that went down about a month before Q school, my first Q school. So, you know, I've been playing the same clubs for probably 8 years at that point, and all of a sudden I got to switch into something completely different. Fortunately, it was great. I mean, it immediately
did you get right through Q school?
Got right through my first year trying, which is huge.
Me and you both, man. Like I never had to go for the second time, which
yeah,
I feel
I don't want to do the second time. That sounds so stressful, especially now knowing like how, you know, your first time through, our assistant coach Doug always said first time through is the easiest because you just don't know. You're just kind of walking through it, happy to be there. And then, you know, every year that you go back or every year that you have to show up again, you just remember a shot here or there, or just, you know, it's
more
just,
pressure, man.
It's a lot of stress that week. So yeah, glad I never had to go back and do that.
That first year that I'd gotten through second stage, I was paired with Patton Kizzire. And you remember Patton, how many years it took him to get out onto the Korn Ferry Tour. And when he finally got to the Korn Ferry Tour, I think he either won the money list or was like second or third.
Yeah.
But, man, I was playing with him that Sunday. And there was a moment where I was like, it's about to blow up. This isn't going to work. Like, it was at, we were at Brooksville. Did you ever play at Brooksville in, down in?
Yeah. That's where I did second stage. Yeah.
Yeah.
But so I did that Monday there a bunch of times too. Yeah.
It was that 11th hole, just like a little dog leg left par four, and he missed it right at the green, and he chili chunked like two chips. Like, he came back to his feet, and they ended up getting the next one up and down. But you knew, like, Patton, like, had a chance to blow up in any second. And I thought that was the reason why he never gotten out there. And he held, it was like, I was like, he's going to blow it. He's going to lose it. And he's like, oh, he's contained himself.
And it's just, what got into Patton that week? I don't know.
I'm glad.
He's always good for a little.
Whatever it was, I'm happy that it, whatever got into him got into him, because he has made one heck of a PGA Tour career out of it.
Yeah, it's just, I'll tell you one thing. Patton's one of my favorite people to play practice rounds with, because you always feel like if you win money off of Patton, it's double. Yeah, yes. He is undisputed the best money on the PGA Tour in a practice round because of what
Tuesdays
or
Sundays, man. Tuesdays or Sundays for him.
Yeah, I mean, it's just he hates losing so much. It just makes so much more fun to beat him.
Does he still play that umbrella game on Tuesdays?
We haven't played umbrella in a while. No, it's mostly
that game. I could not stand, man, because it's all about who hit it closest, like basically determined what the bet was going to do. Because you double it if you're closest. Is that what it was?
Yeah. So I think you get a point for what you get a point for everything.
Stuff,
It
doubles if you're the last guy or something.
It's and then with Patton, especially against somebody that hadn't played it, he'll just throw stuff in there. You know, he's like, oh, I just got up and down on the rough. That's the point. You know.
Oh man, it's when you get to Sea Island, if you ever live there. If you're a newbie, it's almost like a rite of passage. You have to go play with the czar, Pat. It's like, yep, come on, step in the office.
The
like,
godfather, probably.
And he'll be real nice to you before you. He's like, oh, good for you, man. Where are you playing next? Oh, a little mini tour event. Good for you. All right, so we're going to play $100 a hole today. Yeah. And you could double it at any time. Like, that is seriously like how it goes. And every mini tour guy is just like, but it's good to get your kick or your teeth kicked in over there.
Absolutely. he's a blast. He's one of my favorites.
You certainly learned how to compete, that's for dang sure. All right, so I was actually going through your Korn Ferry Tour because I was curious, because I needed a refresher on it. I remember you had won in Kansas City, and I couldn't remember if that was your first year on the Korn Ferry, but it wasn't. You had one prior year where you're kind of just hanging around like 70 to 80 on the money list the whole year. It seemed like a year that was just stuck in neutral, but you kept your card the following year. But the next year wasn't that good, because I was looking at the results, and before you had won in Kansas City, man, I saw that you were 130th on the points list, seven more events away from basically going back to Q school. I mean, where was your mind at heading into Kansas City? Because things obviously clicked, and you needed it.
Yeah, that was a big win. That was incredible. I don't know. I think I missed like three cuts in a row by a shot leading into Kansas City, and felt like I was hitting it pretty good, but couldn't make anything. And I was just, I was not in a great place. I think I just signed up for Q school. And
did you? Oh, yeah. No, you did it.
I basically just admitted defeat. I was like, oh, well, we got, two or three weeks. Just go ahead and sign up, try to get my site that I like, and get some golf going into Q school. Just try to get my game going. And then Kansas City happened, and I don't even, I started making everything that week. I just actually started putting good. And I felt like I was hitting it really good the weeks leading into that. But on the Korn Ferry, you got to putt well. And I was not putting well that year until Kansas City happened. And then fortunately ended up getting my tour card in the finals in Jacksonville.
Yeah, so it's almost similar to a PGA Tour pro who thinks he's gonna miss the cut. He's like, I'm gonna book my flight, and next thing you know, he shoots 65, makes the cut. And
done that before.
You've done that before too.
John Deere, when I won, I booked a flight after the first round. I was like 120th or something. I played terrible, and I was a morning tea time, I think, on Friday, so I went ahead and booked the flight. Putter got hot again. Last three rounds, ended up winning that one.
I tell you what, at Shinny this year, if you shoot 74 the first round, we book a flight. I think the third time's a charm, right?
In all this. Yeah, exactly. Just in case. Yeah.
I was gonna say Augusta, but you're driving to Augusta, so yeah, I know you're not booking a flight there, but
yeah.
Man, all right. So you said, all right, third at the Korn Ferry Tour Championship, and that got your card basically.
Yeah. So I think it was Korn Ferry Tour finals that year. The first two played okay, but nothing special. And then that week,
So I was looking Atlantic at the Beach. Results. All right. So that last event you finished third. Was that Atlantic? Mm-hmm. That was Atlantic Beach?
Atlantic Beach, yeah. Finished third of the last one and ended up sneaking in. I don't know if I finished 21st or 22nd on the finals money list. And that was another special. It was a nice month of golf for me there. That kind of completely changed my trajectory of my golf career.
Yeah, put it in a little perspective here. So that Sunday, you know, heading in, or just that week, it looked like you were playing incredible golf at Atlantic Beach that week. But still, like, what were the emotions like trying to fulfill a dream on Sunday and not screw up, basically?
It was brutal.
Was it just awful?
Yeah. I mean, I think I was well clear. I was like way in. And almost maybe had a chance to, I think Denny McCarthy might have been winning that week and had a chance to kind of catch up to him.
Yeah.
And I just remember all of a sudden I couldn't feel my arms. I couldn't feel my legs. All I could look at was like basically that number of like projected,
every time it just staring you right in the face.
And I think on 16, I made a complete mess of it. Pretty sure it was 16th hole, maybe 17, but I made a triple bogey, and ended up having to par 18 to get my card. And,
man,
that one footer, Never one footer's never looked as long as that one. I think was it Cam was talking about you couldn't get it lined up at the players. Uh-huh. Yeah, that's how I felt. Yeah.
Same deal.
One footer. I mean, the easiest putt in the world is to tap in, and I just stood over it for a little while, just trying to figure out how to pull the trigger.
I mean, it's unbelievable, man, this game. But like once you get over the hump and you get to the PGA Tour and you get to experience it, and I would call your first 3 years almost just, I mean, of course, I'm sure you learned a lot along the way those 3 years. But just looking at your results, it felt like years that you didn't necessarily do anything great, but you didn't do anything necessarily bad either. Is that kind of how you would describe the beginning of your PGA Tour career?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I felt like I just wasn't all that good at that point. I mean, I was definitely good enough to have a tour card and play, you know, PGA Tour events, but I was just not good enough to contend multiple times in a year and actually try to win golf tournaments. You know, I could have lucked into a win here or there, but I was still the same player that was 130th on the Korn Ferry list the year before. You know, that my golf game hadn't changed. But those 3 years were huge. You know, I got to meet my now short game instructor, Tim Yelverton, my rookie year, halfway through my rookie year. Did some unbelievable work with him over the years. And then after about 3 years or so, I'd known him for a while, but started working with John Tillery. And from that point on, it kind of, I'd say, skyrocketed. My golf game got a lot better. I was a lot more control of my long game. And I feel like the last few years I've been able to kind of compete out there.
How would you describe your game when you got to the PGA Tour? If you had to like self rank all of the different attributes of your game, like, how would you describe it?
I would say I was a really talented driver of the ball. I was not a very consistent driver of the ball. I had much higher ball speed. I think it was like 174, 75 ball speed, back then.
Were you really?
Yeah. I used to hit it pretty good. But it was a little bit erratic. You know, one week I'd show up and I'd drive the eyes out of it, and the next week I would just miss every fairway. So, I feel like I was a very talented driver, talented iron player too, but I had no idea how long my irons went. I mean,
really?
Just to look back, I can't even imagine going through a round back then versus now. I mean, I would see a number and I'd be like, yeah, that's a 6 iron, or that feels like a soft 6 iron.
Did you have technology helping you along the way? Like,
I didn't have a TrackMan.
You didn't have any of this.
TrackMan back then. No,
you're just old school.
TrackMan is John Tillery is the one that forced me to buy TrackMan. I hated it. I didn't like it all. But yeah, he forced me to buy one, and ever since then, my entire process around golf has changed.
Wow.
I don't look at the technical side much, but just numbers wise, like I
Yeah.
didn't. If you told me to hit a 147 shot back then, I would have no idea what to do. I'd be like, okay, I'm just gonna hit a pitching wedge, and it's probably gonna go about that number. But now I'm hitting 147 iron with a pitching wedge, 9 iron or 8 iron if I
Yeah.
need to. You know, on the West Coast, the greens are soft. A little chippy 8 iron, so it doesn't spin back. Which back, you know, my first couple of years on tour was never an option for me.
Not even an option. I
I would
mean,
just I would just yell at the ball as it was spinning back off the
right, let's keep working our way down. What about chipping and putting, like heading into the PGA Tour?
Oh, rough. Yeah, not good. Chipping was terrible. I mean, it was a big improvement from college, but it was, I mean, I was one of the worst chippers on tour for sure. Bunker game was actually pretty good. That was
Yeah.
the one of the few bright spots in the short game. And then putting was very inconsistent. You know, I could have a week where I made everything. I felt like I was pretty talented putter as well. You know, when I kind of got the ball started online well, got the speed down pretty good, I was really making a lot of putts. But for the most part, I was very inconsistent with the putter.
The Austrian microwave, we like to call
Yeah,
you with that putter.
exactly. Yeah, it was. Pretty, my whole game, I'd say, as a whole, was pretty inconsistent, but talented in a few areas.
So your first couple of years, if you missed a green in the wrong spot, short-sighted, or you look at a lie in the rough, and you're just like, I don't know what I'm going to do here. Like, when did you finally get with Tim Yelverton, your short game coach, and start to get some confidence, or just some maybe just some better direction of how to approach the short game?
Yeah, so the biggest thing for me was technique. My technique was really bad. I picked it way up with a shut club face, and it was, I just had no loft coming into the golf ball. So over the years, we've taken a lot of angles out. I used to do the lawnmower. I just kind of crank my right arm in and get real narrow, which is not a great way to hit a chip shot. Yeah, so over the years we've cleaned up technique a lot, and then I'd say over the last 3 or 4 years, the biggest thing for that he's taught me is reading lies. He's so good at just teaching different ways to hit shots from different lies, and I think that's such a big, you know, if you have good technique and you're not really getting much out of your short game, that's probably the biggest place to start, because I don't hit a chip shot the same throughout the round, probably, unless you're playing like Palm Springs where every lie is the same. You're probably not going to hit the same technique on more than 3 chips in a round. It varies so much depending on the lie.
And you were a one-trick pony there for a while, like you.
For a while there, I was basically like, I could hit a full flop or I could hit a chip, and that was my two options, and neither of them are very, very effective. So.
Was the flop a little chunky, a little
Oh
diggy?
yeah. It was really a bunker shot. It was really a bunker shot from either rough or fairway. Yeah.
You didn't like dormant season, did you?
I did not. The dormant really gave me the heebie-jeebies, just some flashbacks from my college years.
Oh my gosh. Well, where was the one at was it qualifying in Athens, what you were telling me about that you thought you had figured it out? Next thing you know, you were chipping it across the green.
Yeah, so it was one weekend where the team had gone off to a tournament. I didn't qualify, and I mean, I was watching YouTube videos, and I had this thing figured out. I knew what I was doing, and I told TJ Mitchell when they got back from the tournament. I was like, "Dude, I got this chipping thing figured out," because everybody was trying to help me just somehow get out of this chipping yips. He was like, "Oh, okay." So the first hole at UGA is kind of a funky green. I short-sighted myself left in the fairway, and I chunked my first one, then sculled it over the green, ran all the way across, sculled it back a green, hit my putter that I'd left at my original spot. Ended up making an 8 on that hole, and already had to take an early exit out of qualifying there. And TJ just was dying laughing over there. I
My
mean,
God, but they're crying. I mean, you're just sitting there, just internally, just like, make it stop.
yeah, I mean, at that point, I couldn't do anything but laugh. I mean, it was a hilarious time, and I striped it. I mean, back then
I bet you did.
that was one of my best ball striking years I think I had at Georgia. I was absolutely flushing it, and I couldn't shoot under par because I'd make bogey or double every time I missed a green.
Yeah, Doug and Coach Hack would walk. walk away when you miss the green, just to keep the nerves at bay.
Yeah.
Here.
They didn't want me having any other thoughts. You know, they wouldn't even watch me chip anymore.
Oh my goodness. So I'm looking at some just advanced statistics here. And one of the things that I find super interesting is your approach play. And you talked about, you know, going to work with John Tillery. Of course, I'm sure y'all did tremendous work on changing some technique, how your body moves, especially the pattern that I know y'all try to create. It seems something that isn't one day to the next that y'all are trying to change a whole lot. You just seem to always be working on the same stuff. But I want to just go through some numbers here with you, Sepp. So in 2023, all the way to this year, you finished 23rd, 47th, and 12th in your approach play, which is I find to be extremely elite. So can you just kind of talk about how that part of your game has developed? And of course, you're using Strix on irons with a combo set, which I think is interesting too. You know, you got your 4 and 5 iron being the ZXI5s, which those things are shooting up at the moon. But just kind of talk about that iron play.
Yeah, so iron play, it really has changed a lot. That's kind of the main thing that we tackled when I started working with Tillery. I was decent ball striker. I could flush it. I could hit it really good and it was pretty, but off speed was always a struggle for me. And I had kind of a very heely pattern. So I'd get my right heel in my backswing pretty quick. And then on the way through, I'd get my left heel and kind of spun out a little bit instead of rotational. And we've basically been trying to reverse that pattern a little bit, just be a little more, I guess, effectively a little more centered in my, weight distribution from heel to toe. And
so you try to feel like you're not to interrupt here, but like, so when you say like too much in your heel and then too much in your heel, so when you're turning, are you trying to feel like your foot is flat on the ground, meaning like not too much pressure in your heel or toe on both sides of the swing?
Yeah, so in order to kind of neutralize the pressure, I neutralize the mass, I guess. I've put a lot more pressure. I would say I feel like my right foot on my backswing is sliding towards the ball. I'm putting pressure in towards the ball.
Mm-hmm.
And then the reverse on the downswing. It's my right foot's kind of moving backwards with the pressure, and then my left foot is pushing forward towards the ball, and it's helping me kind of turn into my left side. So that's kind of the
I guess the
general thought on which way that pressure is moving for me.
Okay, that makes sense. And two, your wedge play as well. You know, that's something that I find when I look at your stats too, that is something that is greatly improved. Would you credit all of this to just the work that you and JT have done with technique and then just wearing out the track man working on numbers?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, it's been, like you said, it's nothing. We never made any like wholesale crazy swing changes. That was always my first thing when I went to him, because ball striking was the reason I was even on the PGA Tour. So I was like, I don't want to do anything crazy here. I don't want to have a different golf swing in a month than I do now. Like, let's just, and he's so process oriented anyway. So he's come up with a plan for me over the last few years that we always tweak. And it's a lot of gym work, a lot of drills in the gym, drills on the range. Small stuff every day to kind of make sure my pattern is feeding the right pattern, not the wrong pattern, essentially. And that's just completely changed my golf game. And then from there, hammering those wedge combines and strokes gained games on the track, man, has been huge for me.
What percentage of guys on tour are doing the stroke gain combine, do you think?
I don't know. I feel like everybody should. I mean, I used to hate practicing. I'd just go you remember when you were playing a lot. I mean, I'd be on the golf course every day. I'd just find a game and go play golf every day. And I never practiced. If I was hitting it bad, I'd go hit some balls, but I didn't really know what I was trying to fix. So my whole kind of routine around golf has completely flipped. I still play a good bit of golf when I'm home, but a lot more emphasis on the practice side now.
All right. So these RTC Cleveland wedges that you have, you're going to have to sell some people on this, because a lot of amateurs and a lot of high level players are like, you know what? I got a 60 degree and I want as little amount of bounce as possible, because guess what? That's what Sepp Straka used. He's up 12th in the world. Well, guess what, buddy? Sepp Straka, he doesn't have low bounce on his wedges. He's got full bounce all the way across the board. So can you sell people on why they should have more bounce with their wedges?
Yeah, I mean, unless you're one of the more talented chippers in the world, if you don't practice your chipping, you gotta just give yourself some help. I mean, I know that if you're a bad chipper, you can't just use the bounce and hit behind it, but it's just all it is more forgiveness essentially on a chip shot. And I to this day use a ton of bounce on my, I got 12 degrees of bounce on my 60, full sole. It goes all the way up. So you don't see me like full opening my blade a whole lot unless I'm in a bunker.
So
But
you
with
square chip
that
a lot.
a good bit. And I definitely open it, but it's never like the full laid flat on the ground kind of. I that one still freaks me out a little bit. So looks like a lot of exposure there. So but no, the bounce, I mean, all it's there to do is help.
Hey, you know, a lot of people too. We're selling people on balance, and now we're going to educate people because Augusta National is, of course, a place that people would dream to be able to play it. You and I both have played it. You've played it multiple times, and you got a lot of experience around there now, and you kind of know how the place plays. And what people might think about Augusta is that, man, there's nothing out of place at Augusta National. Flowers are perfect. It's perfectly manicured. But when you play it, and you start to realize how the golf course plays, and you have lies around Augusta that are not American Express lies, that aren't sitting on tees,
No.
that are very difficult to spin. And you're sitting there like, man, I've watched the Masters growing up as a kid, and I swear I thought everybody had perfect lies because it looks so green. Can you tell us
Yeah.
about like what it's actually like playing Augusta National around the greens?
It is tough. I mean, it looks beautiful on TV. It looks beautiful in person. It looks great. And then you get up there and you're actually looking at the lie and you're like, this is not what I want. I mean, there's a reason why it's so hard to get up and down around Augusta. And you always watch on TV and you're like, how did that guy just hit that chip shot? You know, just hit a nice little spinner up there. But it is, I mean, it's into the grain. Everything gets mowed into you. And it's tough. I mean, they make it really, really hard in every aspect. And honestly, that's one of the places where I think a lot of people do add bounce to their wedges, just because it is, you know, it's easy to kind of duff a chip out there, to be honest with you. So, yeah, they make it really tough around there. And yeah, all the bounce you can have is nice
Well,
to add.
I just want to kind of talk about like two specific chip shots. Right of 11. If you ever go to Augusta National on a practice round, you'll see guys chipping right of 11 for 5 to 8 minutes while they're just trying to figure out how that first bounce is if you're going to play the bump shot, or hey, maybe my lie is good enough to kind of open the face and play a spinner here. And then you also go, let's say, long or right of the sixth green when that pin is up top on top right of that shelf. Similar type of shot where it's so quick when the golf ball finally gets on the green that if your lie is not that great, or if it even if it is good, just talk about the indecision and the challenge that you have on chip shots like this at Augusta National.
Yeah, I mean, like you just said, the greens, once it gets on the green, it's so fast, but everything until it gets to the green is so slow. You know, every time when you hit a bumper, it checks in there so hard, and it changes so much even depending on when you're playing. Like if you just had a little bit of rain, that thing is skipping through the first to the fringe.
Wow.
If it's in the afternoon and it's you know, it's just a perfect day, it's going to be grabbing pretty hard. So you'll see people all week just chipping around the greens, you know, different times a day, just trying to get a feel for how the ball is going to react, because there's such a contrast in speed from the fringe to the green. And that's one of the things that makes it so hard to get up and down around that place.
Does anybody ever really figure out Augusta National like fully?
I don't think so. You know, I think once you think you've got it figured out, it probably, what did Bryson say about shooting? It's a par
Yeah,
68 or
it's a
something,
par
and
68.
then break that score until years later when he was in contention last year. So it's just one of those places where when you're feeling good and you're playing well, it just feels like you make so many birdies. And then the next day you go out there and all of a sudden it just feels like you're just grinding for pars. So it's one of those places that when you're uncomfortable or you're just off a little bit, it makes you really try to figure out how to get the ball in the hole.
gosh, I mean, it's a place that if you can find 14 or 15 greens, you're just like, man, let's just, can we just have like a chill round here to Augusta National, a stress-free round? Because that's a lot of fun. When you get in some bad spots out there, you're just like, gosh.
Yeah, there's nothing better than going around Augusta flushing it. Because if you're flushing it, you know, you're going to have birdie putts, and that's fun. It's so much fun to play that place when you're hitting it good. But when you're not hitting it good, you're going to get punished.
100%. Well, Charlie, I think for a guy that's on his entering his eighth season on the PGA Tour, which, by the way, how quickly did that go, Sep?
I don't know. You saying that, I thought you might have been talking about somebody else there.
8th year. So, Charlie, coming in for short-sighted.
Thanks for the intro there, Smiley. Although I am a little bummed to have to inform my 3-year-old tomorrow morning who plays golf left-handed that Sep and Smiley said, hey, it's over, buddy. Try a different game. It's not worth it.
Phil did pretty good now, okay?
It looks natural. I'd flip him around if it didn't look natural. But yeah, to your point, it maybe if I flip it around, I'll decide, hey, no, right-handed, no good. We can't do that. So short side, we're going to go through a little lightning round here, Sep. We got a few kind of fun questions for you. And where I want to start is we're going to pull the curtain back here on the production a little bit. We're recording this during Houston week, but you're obviously sitting at home. You're not playing. And I'm wondering if there's any party that's missing the food at El Tiempo.
Oh, man. That place is unreal. Absolutely. El Tiempo is one of my favorite restaurants in the world. That's, I mean, the old school carnitas. They give you a little cup of melted butter on the side. Dip it in. That place is unreal.
So that's a good, that's a go-to. The carnitas at El Tiempo with a little melted butter on the side.
Yeah. Yeah. That, I mean, it's one of the best dishes you'll ever have.
Extra butter.
I love that. Okay, great. All right. So the next place I want to go is, you mentioned Fontana Golf Club. Am I saying that correctly in Austria earlier? All right.
Yeah.
I think that potentially one of the most important golf glove sale transactions in the history of the game happened there. I want you to tell me about when Mary sold a golf glove to Peter and that pro shop.
That was actually the pro shop she owned before that. And
really?
Eichenton in Salzburg, just outside of Salzburg. Yeah. And my dad was from Vienna, but he was over there playing a golf tournament. And yeah, she sold him a golf glove at the, in the pro shop before the round. And yeah, here I am, you know.
did they just, you know, did he end up asking her on a date after? Like, what happens after the
golf club sale? I think he was there maybe for a weekend or something, and they kind of hit it off. I didn't go into details or anything. So, married for, boy, I don't know, 36 years now or so. Yeah.
Hey, Charlie. Well,
yes.
So you're telling me all these guys that are playing out in the golf course, they got a chance with the cart girl, is what you're telling me?
No, see, they got it all wrong. It's, you got to go for the girl in the shop who knows a little bit about golf. You're barking up the wrong tree. You're worried about getting a cocktail.
When I pay for my round, okay.
That's right. That's where it's got to happen.
All right, guys.
So, there you go.
Get those range prices probably gone up now. You might have to buy some irons or something.
Okay, so then you all move, you know, to when you're at Fontana, and you know, I know you and Sam very competitive as kids. You know, we could get to the golf, but I'm actually more interested in were you, when you rode your bikes to Fontana, were those like some races? Like, who came out on top with the bike race to Fontana?
Sam always beat me any kind of race. He was I was a pretty chubby kid, kind of been that way my whole life. So he was always the fast one. I played goalie. He was striker. So it was from an early age, he was always faster. And now golf swing faster too. So yeah, it was always meant to be that way.
I'm a little bummed that Sam made you quit soccer, because a goalie named the Ox, like, that would have been a kind of a generational shot stopper. Yeah.
I mean, it was probably a good move, though. I don't know that the golf would have the goalie would have worked out the way the golf did.
Okay, so I'm not trying to be presumptive here, so it's all hypothetical. But let's just say we're putting together a menu for like a well-known golf dinner. All right, some of the collection of the best-known players in the world. All right. And I want a rough draft version that's centered around the schnitzel, okay? Because I hear you're a big schnitzel guy. You maybe even make a good schnitzel, like an Austrian this year. Put it together.
I make a decent schnitzel. Yeah, I make a decent schnitzel.
Decent's acceptable.
It's hard. It's really hard to make it right. The air pockets are really hard to get just right. And but I love, schnitzel is incredible.
Okay. All right, so schnitzel, we'll have to get a preview of the Sep Straka decent schnitzel at some point. You guys talked about Q School in 2016. Obviously, big kudos to Srixon for their part in that. But I also hear that there was a key piece, which was the Diet Coke you got at a Krispy Kreme. that really kind of fueled you there. I'm a Coke heavy guy myself, so we kind of live in adjacent universes, but I think we understand each other a bit. Can you explain to me where the Mo from the Diet Coke comes and whether it is the first sip or the last sip of the Diet Coke that contains the Mo?
Yeah, it's you got to drink the whole thing. So I guess the last sip would be the Mo. Yeah, you got to drink the whole Diet Coke. If you're struggling around at the turn, go to the turn house, get a Diet Coke. You can't just take a couple sips. It's not going to work. You got to go the full thing. But the Krispy Kreme was a fun story. It was first stage at Q School. And I think I shot like 74 or 75. And me, Michael Johnson, and Tom Lovelady were on the same site. And we were kind of hanging out throughout the whole process of Q School together. But yeah, went through a Krispy Kreme. The days in I was staying at had a Krispy Kreme right next door. So went through, grabbed a few Krispy Kreme donuts and a Diet Coke. And then ended up making it through. So I had to go back to Krispy Kreme every night after that one, obviously.
That's fantastic.
Was that Tom's idea or your idea?
No, that was me. Actually, Tom and MJ were shocked that I did it. But yeah, I Mookie was also there. Mookie DeMoss was. He was there too. And they all had a good laugh about that one.
And you need the Mo. Got to go find the Mo. And
then gotta find the Mo.
I love it.
Especially if you shot 74, 75, you need something to change, you know?
All right, I'm watching the TGL finals right now as we do this interview. And so I want to say, let's say we just create TGL expansion team. It's called Dogs GC. All right, you're the captain. What other three Georgia guys are on that team with you?
Ooh, oh man. That is a long
guys?
List.
You get two guys
there.
Or three guys?
That's what I'm saying.
You get three guys?
Well, three guys, because Sep and three other guys.
Okay.
Four-man team.
You got to have Grayson on there for the jokes, Grayson Sig. He is probably the funniest, not only Georgia guy, probably the funniest golfer in professional golf. He's hilarious. So Grayson be on there. I'd go probably Chris Kirk. He's kind of going to be the captain, the
glue
ring
guy.
Leader.
Glue
yeah.
guy.
Love that.
Glue guy. He's going to book our house. You know, it's always in Jupiter, but he'll probably book our house for the night and he'll have everything set up for us. He already does that on the road every week. So, and then, boy, I feel like we need some distance. Who hits it far from Georgia, guys? I don't even know.
Harris?
Yeah, Harris got some speed, and he's pure. So, yeah, we'll go Harris. Yeah.
Love
That'd
it.
Be good.
That's a squad right there. I love it. All right. So, and then on the topic of the Dogs, all right, so I want to know which one of these things you'd rather see happen. The Braves beat the Mets in the NLCS or Georgia beats Auburn in the SEC title game?
Neither of those are very realistic because the Mets generally don't, you know, I mean.
Well, okay. It's
and Auburn hadn't been in the SEC. Here
he goes.
That's a great way to answer that question.
here's that Georgia entitlement, man. It's unbelievable.
Actually, the last time Auburn was in the SEC championship, we did beat them, 2019. That's the year I met my wife, so.
Oh, my goodness. Yep.
Well,
I need an answer.
Which one is it?
Oh, I still got to answer it. I'll go Dogs. Just get another SEC championship, but it's close.
Okay. I love it. Well, I'm glad you brought up Paige because I just want to know on a scale of 1 to 10, how worried are you that the Auburn Alex Golish hire is going to tip the household trash talk scales? Like any nerves at all on that?
Not really. I mean, we've been through this before, you know. I just don't think. Everybody's excited about Golish. You know, maybe he's great, but I just don't see it happening. How many years is now?
Hey, you and I deal with the same thing, man. Like we both got Auburn girls, and
yeah,
we just try to support them best we can. You know,
that's so
it's
good
tough. Yeah, I will say it is tough sometimes. You know, because all you want to do is just talk trash.
I want to be happy.
You know, you have to go to bed. You know you have to go to bed that night, so it's you gotta maybe console a little bit.
Let's hope they both stop listening to this episode maybe like 2 or 3 minutes ago. The final one, Sep, is, you know, obviously we love being dads on this podcast where you and Smiley started. So I just want to know, you know, as a dad of a 3 and a 1 year old, you're in a similar phase. What are your current favorite activities respectively to do with Leo and Thomas?
With Leo, I would say Man, any kind of sports. He loves sports. Awesome. I couldn't get him off the putting green tonight. He's just hammering balls into the bushes, little plastic balls. He absolutely loves it. So that's always pretty fun. And Thomas is starting to laugh a little bit. So just trying to tickle him, get him to laugh is pretty special.
I love it. That's awesome. Well, that's what I got, Smiley. That's all for short-sighted.
Thank you, buddy. I got one more question for you. Hang in here with Charlie. Man, Ryder Cup, we didn't ask you a question about that. What's the best part about playing in a Ryder Cup? Because I imagine just the experience that you get from it, the friends that you make along the way, the memories that you have to this point, playing in two of them just got to be incredible.
Yeah, I mean, Ryder Cup is unlike any tournament that you'll ever play. I mean, it's unlike any experience you'll have in life. Those guys, I feel like I'm so fortunate to have played with essentially the same 11 guys. I mean, identical twins, you know, we switched out there, but
same team.
Yeah, exactly. But they're both around in both Ryder Cups. So, yeah, it's so special, the friendships that you make, the bonds that you create, and how special they make the experience for you. You know, that week, the weeks leading up to it, even the year leading up to it, everything's just geared towards how can we get the team that firing on all cylinders. Mm-hmm. How can we get everybody playing their best and the best mindset and just to enjoy the experience. I think that's the biggest thing, is they make it so fun to be a part of that team.
And how good is this, Smiley, that looking back on talking to Sepp at the BMW Championship of 2024, we asked him about the atmosphere at Bethpage and Ryder Cup. He said, I don't know if I'm ready. It's in our show open now.
Oh, it is
on
our
Golf Channel
open.
Every week. Have and he was ready. Up? He was wrong. He was ready. He was perfectly fine. They retained the ride, the cup. So yeah, that opens our show every week on Golf Channel.
Having John Rahm as a partner will get you ready. Yeah. Turns out that guy's pretty good at golf. So yeah, that was a fun couple of days getting to play with him.
Is Luke Donald trying to start a dynasty, by the way? Is he trying to enter the Nick Saban conversation or Kirby Smart conversation as greatest coach to ever do it?
Yeah, I mean, if he if we pull this one off in Ireland, I think it'd be undeniable that he is. I mean, in my mind, he already is. He's the stuff he's done. I mean, going to Bethpage was always marked as impossible. You know, they said it would be impossible for us to win there. And he made it to where every one of us believed by the time we teed off that it was possible. And he said it in his opening speech in New York was incredible. I don't know if y'all saw it, but briefly talked about how honored he was to be there, how honored we all were to be there. But to make no mistake, we were there to win. And I think that got everybody pretty fired up. And it was such a special, special week. And so excited that he's doing it again.
Man, to be a part of a Ryder Cup winning team, man, yeah, I bet you got some dang good memories. I wish you were a GoPro on your head at both of those celebrations because I wish I could live those moments with you. But we're just going to have to talk about them in the Vestavia Country Club or Shoal Creek locker room. You have to tell us those stories because I can't imagine how fun that was.
Yeah, that was a blast. Yeah, those some of those might have to stay in the locker room. Man, such a great time.
Seth, there's one short-sighted question. I need like a bonus one for this interview because I got such a kick out of this. I was bopping around the Seminole Pro member just trying to see who was there warming up. And I looked over on the putting green. I was like, what's that guy do? Like, he's not wearing a hat. We're in like South Florida. The sun's baking out. Oh, that's Sepp Straka. Just kind of working on the hat tan. Is that kind of your play unless you need one on the course?
Yeah, I was trying to level out the hat tan a little bit that day. It might have looked like a shining light out there because I think I was a little lazy going into that. It was pretty white on the dome. So
did you go no hat all day long?
I did. Yeah. Wow. I wish I would at least put one in the bag for the back nine. It got a little toasty out there.
No sunglasses, nothing. Just straight up.
Not a sunglass
all the way.
Guy. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, I just went straight.
That's
bald.
Impressive. That's really impressive.
I mean, I know you love Srixon, and at times I think Srixon hates you for not wearing your hat more than you should out there. Because too often I looked down and I was like, eh, he's not wearing the hat again.
I know. I've waited. I keep waiting on Trixon to reach out and be like, hey, dude, you got to, you know, at least when you're in contention, just put on the hat just in between shots. But
hey, but I understand. I mean, you got Stuart Sink and Brant Snedeker just to check out. It's like, all right, if I keep wearing this hat every day, I'm going to have that problem.
I know. I'm trying to leave Stuart up to that honor.
Yeah, I love it. All right, Sepp. Well, we appreciate you coming on, buddy. See you in San Antonio. And of course, best of luck in this year's first major.
Absolutely. Thanks, guys. Appreciate you having me on.
Go Dawgs.
Thank you.
Go Dawgs.
We'll see you next week on the Golf Channel. This has been The Smiley Show.
You know, I listen to this podcast. It's really cool. And
all of our lovely fans and subscribers, but make sure you like and subscribe.
It's cool to see what you guys are doing. I know golf fans appreciate it, but we do too. So please keep it up.
For all the good people of YouTube, like and subscribe.
You guys have some good takes, so I'm happy to come on and shoot the